Hey, I've been looking forward to our next guest for, I think it's almost a month now. Candace Platter wrote a blog, an article, September 12th, asking the question, why, since we know so much about the prescription drugs today, meaning the medical community, why do the problems persist? Candace Platter, author, Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, the Top 10 Survival Tips for Loving Someone with an Addiction. Candace, thanks for being with me tonight.
Hi, Larry. You're welcome.
Well, the marvels of modern technology. You are in Vancouver, British Columbia. Is that correct?
That is correct.
You can't be any further away from the radio show than that.
Yeah, and stay on the same continent.
It's still daylight there, isn't it?
It's 6:30 in the evening. The sun is just setting. It's absolutely gorgeous here.
Sister, you graduated, and this is another thing that caught my eye, Adler School of Professional Psychology, master's degree 2001, in addition to all your other accomplishments. Adler, what got you interested in Adler with when you talk about so many different avenues that you can go with in psychology?
I think the most there were a few things that really intrigued me about this form of psychology when I was looking at a school to do my master's at. You know, Adler's psychology is called individual psychology, and what that means is that it's a little misleading in English. He was from Vienna. But individual psychology means that we treat the individual as a whole. We look at every facet, we look at everything, and treat them as an individual.
So I really
liked that. I also like the fact that he's very, very concerned about what he called social interest, meaning that we find the best ways that we can, each of us, to give back to the world and to contribute and to find our sense of belonging to the world. So, you know, there are a number of things that I love about Adlerian psychology. Those are the first two that come to mind.
You know, and just Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, the book you wrote, you know, it clearly, I think in terms when I heard you say the individual as a whole, clearly you don't look at someone as just from the neck up then. It's really evident. Folks, if you read the book, that one comment that Candace just said, you treat the individual as a whole, your book clearly covers that. So I find that to be interesting in the beginning stages of this interview.
Because we can't just treat somebody with an addiction in isolation. We need to be able to look at that person, what's causing the addiction, what's underneath that. Addiction is a symptom of what's underneath it. And also be looking at and treating the family system as a whole and looking at their loved ones and what's going on with them and, you know, what kinds of contributions are happening there as well. So it's looking at every facet.
Well, you indicated you spent a great deal of time with loved ones.
I do. I specialize in working with the loved ones of people with addictions. Yep. And I when I say addiction, I'm talking about addiction across the board. So it's not just alcohol or drugs or, you know, it's eating disorders and smoking and gambling and sex addiction and codependency in relationships and overspending and internet addiction, which is becoming quite a, you know, important addiction right now. So anything that a person, any behavior or substance that a person is using to kind of escape from their lives. And in fact, Adler talks about life tasks. And, you know, so any behavior or substance that people are using to escape from their life tasks, to not have to deal with reality, that's an addiction.
Well, let me ask you.
Addictive behavior.
Well, let me ask you this. Of course, radio show, prescription addiction, breaking the silence. But is there a common theme amongst many of the addictive patterns that you see?
Yes, and it's becoming more and more so, which is just astonishing to me with everything that we know today. Because, you know, I first was addicted to prescriptions 40 years ago when I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease, which is a very painful and debilitating illness. And at that point, the doctors didn't know anything about it. It was pretty new on the horizon. And what they did was they prescribed Valium and codeine and Demerol, and which I think today would be somewhere, something around OxyContin, and I just, you know, they just kept giving me as many prescriptions as I wanted to for years and years and years. I took these drugs on good faith. My doctors had prescribed them, so of course they would be okay, not understanding or realizing at all that anybody's body would become addicted to these substances, and mine certainly did.
You know, in this article that you wrote, posted September 12th, these physicians are armed with loaded guns in the form of their prescription pads.
They are. And we're seeing it more and more. You said it at the beginning of the show, where people are dying, people are overdosing accidentally, purposefully, people are getting very sick. Yeah, they're... The doctors have loaded guns that they have in the form of their prescription pads. I totally believe that. But I really want to say that not all doctors are doing this. I really want to say this. Not all doctors are doing this. You know, there are many, many very ethical doctors who don't do this. But there are so many who are doing it that it's still a terrible problem, at least in North America that I know of. In Canada, it's happening. In the States, it's happening. Bad situation.
Well, you know, we have friends in Canada, and clearly there's many, many parallels going on between Canada and the United States when we start talking about the prescription drug epidemic. You know, you came up with a statistic here that I wasn't aware of. It says, despite its prevalence and impact, mentioning specifically addiction. Addiction is linked to more than 70 diseases or conditions and accounts for a third of inpatient hospital costs.
So it says in a study done by CASA, right?
Yeah. The subject's rarely taught in medical school, residency training. You've got almost a million practicing physicians in the United States, and only about 1,200 are trained in addiction medicine.
Isn't that amazing? Isn't that horrifying? 1,200? I mean, I said in that article that I'm not particularly good in math and don't particularly want to become even better at math, so I didn't look at the ratio, but a million practicing physicians, 1,200 of them have some education around addiction medicine.
Well, there's indications here where, just recently I talked about, I think it was 35% of the doctors only 35% of the doctors knew that there was additional educational material available at this point in time. So you're right. The medical profession as a whole, has to do a better job at both educating and by this radio show standards, policing the profession.
Yes, and being interested in the topic and seeing what's around them.
Well, you know, I'm a practicing pharmacist, and I don't want to get too far off base because we really do want to talk about your book. Folks, if you just joined us, Candace Platter wrote the book Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, The Top 10 Survival Tips for Loving Someone with an Addiction. We're going to get deeper into that book. But I already forgot what I was going to say, which is good. I do want to focus on your book. Are there many books out there right now that focus on the loved one?
Certainly not enough. No, there aren't very many. The reality is that there are very few services, at least here in Canada, there are very few services that specialize in working with the loved ones. And that needs to change so much. We have a wonderful 12-step program, Al-Anon, that works with loved ones. We have some treatment centers across Canada that have family programs, and those are becoming a little bit more prevalent. We have some outpatient alcohol and drug services. We have some here in Vancouver that are just wonderful that have, you know, groups. One of them is called Affected Others. We have groups like that, you know, self-help groups, and some of them are led by counselors. But in terms of, again, a ratio between what's offered for people who are addicts, who are addicted, and again, we're just talking about alcohol and drugs. There are hardly any treatment centers for somebody with gambling addiction, which can be just disastrous for a family, or smoking, or, you know, those other kinds of addictions that can be terrible for people. There are very few treatment centers for the addicts, and there's nothing at all for the loved ones. So this is one of the reasons that that I've decided to work in this field with specifically with loved ones and to work with addiction across the board. So I work with, you know, people who are the partners or the family, the loved ones of people with gambling addiction, for example. I work with partners of sex addicts. I work with partners just across the board, not just partners, children, you know, parents, aunts, uncles, cousins. Today, it's very hard to find somebody who isn't affected by somebody else's addiction.
Well, that leads me into a major question here. Listening to you, you've been doing this counseling for 20 years, you indicated.
Yes.
Do you see your services, is your phone ringing more and more on a monthly basis? Not so much because you're as good as you are, but because you have a feeling that this problem continues to grow?
Absolutely. You know, when I give workshops or talks, one of the things I ask for is a volunteer to be an addict, to be the addict. So that person comes up and stands at the front of the room. And then I ask, who is affected by this person's addiction? And so somebody will say, oh, the mother. Okay, so you come up and be the mother. Who else is affected? The father. You come up and be the father. The children, the, you know, the worker, the colleagues, the bosses, the teachers, the doctors, the neighbors. So at the front of the room, we have dozens of people who are affected by one person's addiction. And this is happening all over the world, everywhere.
You know, this radio show.
The answer to your question, Larry, is absolutely. I hear more and more and more from the loved ones, especially when they know that I know how to help them.
Well, you know, Candace, this radio show host. You know, you just became aware of my show in the last couple of weeks. I'm not tremendously a moralist. I don't believe in loss to any great degree, but I also am seeing a society where. You indicated gambling, internet problems, you know, people becoming addicted to the internet, obviously drug addiction, alcohol. We have a tremendous marketing campaign in every one of those areas that continually introduce these substances or avenues or mediums to the public. And there's very little education pushing back.
Yes.
And again, when you say the internet addiction, quite frankly, I never thought about it, but it would make sense. We have people that just can't get off the internet.
Yeah, and they're looking at a variety of things. You know, I mean, we could call it computer addiction too. I mean, some of it isn't necessarily internet addiction. Some of it is gaming with games that you buy elsewhere and you just play on your computer. But, you know, people are looking at porn. People are doing a lot of shopping online and spending money they don't have. People are gambling online now much more than they ever have before, and a lot of governments are endorsing that and promoting that. So there are all kinds of ways to be addicted to the internet or be addicted to your computer or, you know, whatever your device is. It doesn't even have to be a computer anymore.
And, of course, every community in North America, I'll just leave it at North America right now, is paying for this for the marvelous marketing that's going on to promote all these avenues of possible addiction. Hey, getting back to your book, I think I made, I took these notes. There's a total of 10 chapters, and I wrote these notes just in the first 7. I did read the whole book, but I stopped taking notes after about 7. You covered self-respect of the loved one. Can you change an addict's behavior? Let's see, helping versus enabling. Do you have to be? Do you have to remain addicted to someone else's addiction? I thought that was in. Where do we start with your book? We've only got about 8 minutes going into this final, you know, into this segment, and I go on and on. Forget and run. You can't enjoy happiness. Is there one area that you feel that we should not miss?
The thing that I would say, and thank you for pointing all of that out. I can definitely speak for a while on any of those things. I love the self-respect topic, and maybe we'll have time to get back to that. But what happens for loved ones, you know, they're often doing many of the wrong things because they just don't know what to do. And they love their addicted loved ones so dearly. They're so scared, and they're so worried, and they don't know what to do to help somebody who is in this situation. And often they're doing things that actually perpetuate the addiction rather than doing more to stop it. So when loved ones can start to understand that and start to understand really the difference between enabling and helping, a lot of things change. Because enabling is not a loving act toward an addict. Giving an addict, for example, a drug addict or an alcoholic or a gambler or a shopper, giving them money is not a good idea.
Well, you actually helped redefine.
Can I just finish
absolutely.
My thought
absolutely.
About this? Is that what happens for the loved one is that they tend to become what I call addicted to the addict's addiction. And what that means is that when the addict is doing well, the loved one is doing well. Everything's fine, you know. When the addict is not doing well, the loved one is just collapsed into all kinds of worry and all kinds of tension and terrible, terrible feelings. And so there's this roller coaster. Addicts are usually on an emotional roller coaster anyway. And the loved one of the addict is joining on that roller coaster. And what I do to help the loved ones is to get them off that roller coaster and put more emphasis on their own lives. Get their own lives back on track. Many of them have put their lives, their needs on the back burner for years and years and years, giving all of their attention to the addict. And that's not good for anyone, including the addict, especially the addict. So it's a real lose-lose situation. So what I do is I help them look at their self-respect. I help them look at what really is going to work here, what's going to make a difference here, what can the loved one do to actually help and not enable this situation.
Well, you said it well, because I was going to emphasize that you, in fact, redefined enabling for me as I read the book. And I think what I got out of it most is you have to take care of yourself. You have to get a better
grasp. You absolutely do. Yeah, you have to take care of yourself first. And of course, the analogy I use, we've all heard this analogy, is when you're on the airplane and, you know, the stewardess or the flight attendant is saying, you know, when we hit the dreaded turbulence, the mask will drop down, right? And what they say always is to put your own mask on first. Even if you're traveling with a child or you're traveling with somebody who's ill, you put your own mask on first, because if you can't breathe, how can you help somebody else breathe? And it's the same with being the loved one of an addict. If you're not taking care of yourself, how can you possibly help, not enable, but help somebody else?
Well, so many times I've thought about enabling someone who doesn't enable is the individual, and this would be a parent interacting with a child.
Or an adult child, maybe. Different when it's, when it's an actual child who's addicted.
You know, at my age, even my 30-year-old is my child. I'm glad you clarified that. Definitely an adult child. Thank you. But my point is, you throw them out of the house. I've had enough of this. I'm not going to put up with this. I throw them out of the house. Hmm. And to me, that was always the definition of what a non-enabler did. They divorced themselves from the actions. But I want to clarify what I'm hearing from you is you get yourself in order.
Yeah. There are things to do first before you throw somebody out of the house.
Yeah, that's exactly what I picked up from your book.
I will say that a lot of the people who wind up coming to me are so at the end of their rope that it doesn't take them very long to get to the place of, you know, I'm not going to put up with this anymore. And that's a good boundary. That's a really healthy boundary. And a lot of addicts change when they are presented with that boundary. But there are things to try first. So I'm not sitting here advocating that every loved one of an addict, you know, be really forceful and say, okay, that's it, you're gone. I'm not helping you. I'm not doing anything for you anymore. No, there, you know, that's the end of a spectrum. There's a lot of things to look at before you get to that place.
Folks, Candace Platter, Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, the top 10 survival tips for loving someone with an addiction. You know, I owe you a huge on-air apology, Candace. We have not linked your book up with our guest page, Prescription Dictionary guest page. We're going to get that done within the next day or two. But for right now, how do you find your book, Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself?
How do I sell it?
How do you find it on the internet?
Yeah, you can, through my website, which is www.candaceplatter.com, and if it's okay, I'd like to spell my name because there's so many different spellings that people could have. So Candace is C-A-N-D-A-C-E, and Platter is P-L-A-T-T-O-R.
Okay.
So it's CandacePlatter.com. We used to sell the book on the website. We don't do that anymore, but you can download the ebook. You can get the ebook on my site.
And that's how that is exactly.
But the book is in a variety of bookstores across North America. There are some
US
as well.
Candace, we're going to be cut off here on our hard 10 o'clock break. But you've been gracious enough to stick with us, Candace Platter. Radio time is, I don't like, you know, one of the things about radio is I find myself interrupting people because we have to go into those hard breaks, and I interrupted you. One more time, Candace is C-A-N-D-A-C-E, and Platter is P-L-A-T-T-O-R.
Correct.
And, of course, you can still get the book on Amazon, you said?
Yes, anywhere in the world that has Amazon, you can get my book.
And I would assume that if you just do a search on one of the engines, Google, Yahoo, MSN, Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, probably be able to find it.
You'll find it, absolutely. In fact, you'll also find a workbook that Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, the first book was published about 2.5 years ago, and the workbook that accompanies it was published in January of this year. And so the workbook is for loved ones who would like to go deeper into what their issues are about and why they enable and what their families of origin were like and getting to know themselves better, especially for people who may not have access to a therapist, maybe somebody who lives in a very small town or something like that. But I use it with a lot of my clients, and there's a group now of loved ones that's using it for their group. They're doing a step a week or a step every 2 weeks. A tip, I should say, not a step. It's not a 12-step based. There are 10 tips, so they're doing a tip a week and finding that very helpful.
You know, something I found interesting towards the end of your book is just how do you go about finding a competent therapist. Obviously, if you're within the Vancouver area, they're taken care of. But in other parts of North America, it appears that you have concerns about people finding the right individual for their
needs. Absolutely. Absolutely. You have to have somebody that you're feeling comfortable with, somebody that, you know, you have some kind of emotional rapport with, and somebody that you believe knows this situation and can actually help you with it. I do telephone counseling, just for people to know. I have clients in the U.S. I have clients in Hong Kong and Australia, you know, and various places. But, you know, I think if you Google family addiction or something like that, family addiction and then your city or town, you may be able to find either a therapist or a program that that might be able to help you.
You know, I always make it a standard that I don't surprise a guest, but I think you could probably have an opinion on this, Candace. I found it intriguing when we talked about there being a common thread among so many of the addictions, whether it's gambling, the internet, pornography, and of course drugs, alcohol. I think the common thought now is that addiction, and I think when most people say addiction, quite frankly, they're thinking drugs and alcohol. I think that
mostly, that is a
safe. And we think of it as a brain disease. And I think it's pretty well accepted that it's a brain disease. And, of course, the assumption is that the brain disease was created by the actual chemicals or the actual alcohol. Now, when we start talking about gambling or the internet type situations or shopping, Those are not chemically induced.
Right.
So now you've really got my curiosity up, which is maybe a whole nother show. But but when we talk about addiction as a brain disease, but yet you see where I'm coming with this question, is it a brain disease if in fact there's so many common threads between the addictions that are both chemically based and non-chemically based? Is it a brain disease?
Well, I'm not an expert in this field, but my opinion is that it's not an actual disease, like a medical disease. The reason that I say that is because if you have, I know that 12-step people believe addiction to be a disease, and I understand where they're coming from. And you know, I have 25 years clean and sober myself now, and I most of my recovery has been in 12-step programs, so I really understand where what they're talking about. What's different for me is that I have a medical disease. I have Crohn's disease, and anybody with something like Crohn's, cancer, diabetes, you know, something like that, cannot say to themselves, gee, I think I just won't have Crohn's disease anymore. I won't have diabetes anymore. I don't want it anymore, so I'm not going to have it anymore. I'm sick and tired of it. But you can do that with addiction. You can arrest an addiction and stop it. It's not that simple. There's work to do. But you can stop an addiction. You can't just stop having Crohn's, unfortunately, or many other, you know, medical diseases. What there is brain involvement. Absolutely. There's physical involvement of the body in a number of ways, and the brain is one of those ways. So, you know, when you're doing something that feels really good, you're high on drugs or you're in the mall and you're about to pay for something and have it put in a bag for you, or you're about to turn on your computer and look at porn, whatever it is, those endorphins get released. So there's brain involvement, and this is why people use addiction. The ironic thing about addiction is that we're trying to make ourselves feel better with it. That's the irony of addiction. We want to feel better. It's almost like a twisted version of self-care, right? It's a negative version of self-care, because it always comes around and bites you on the butt if you're using an addictive behavior or substance. But we start using addictions to feel better. And so the brain helps us feel better. But I personally don't see it as a medical disease. I have a problem with that, probably because I have a medical disease that I can't get rid of. There's no known cause or cure for what I have.
Well, I think it's a fascinating topic. And I'm not in any position whatsoever to question or challenge anything that you've said, because in your book, in fact, you've indicated that there are different kinds of addictions. One would be considered a mood-altering versus a mind-altering.
Yep. And you know, the other thing about, I'll get to that in a minute, the other thing about whether it's a disease or not is that whether it is a disease or it isn't, whether it's something that you learned growing up in your family, like, you know, when the going gets tough, the tough go shopping kind of thing, whatever started this addiction for you, it is a choice, ultimately, about whether you're going to continue it or you're not. For me, it almost doesn't matter whether it's a disease. I look at, again, you know, 12-step people. I'm one of them. I'm in recovery. I have 25 years of recovery because whether it's a disease or not, I choose every single day not to engage in addiction. And millions of people all over the world who are in 12-step programs where they believe that it's a disease recover from this or are in recovery from this every day. So it's a choice. Everything, all of it, no matter what it is, ultimately it boils down to a choice of, are you going to do this behavior or are you not?
Well, hopefully there's a number of people out there like yourself that can help those individuals make the right choices.
Make that choice and understand why they haven't been, perhaps, making that choice.
Oh, there's no question in my mind that people do need more insight and understanding as to why they do what they do. And a competent therapist can certainly help move them in that direction. You know,
and so you had asked the difference between a mind-altering and a mood-altering. Did you want to go there for a minute?
Well, yeah, let's do that. Those are, again, two terms or a differentiation of terms that I had not seen before or given much thought to.
Mm-hmm. Well, a mind-altering addiction is something that actually alters the brain in the sense that drugs and alcohol do, where you're actually intoxicated. Where, you know, you're unable to perform functions like driving or that kind of thing. A mood-altering addiction, even though mind-altering addictions also alter the mood, a mood-altering addiction doesn't necessarily alter the mind. So a mood-altering addiction would be something like gambling or smoking or shopping or looking at porn. You can still drive your car. I mean, you may be absorbed in some thinking that, you know, you might not be totally present in your car when you're driving, but you're not intoxicated in the same way that a mind-altering substance will do to you. So for me, there are differences between a substance and a behavior.
Would the same basic feelings come out of whatever is creating the stimulus? In other words, does an individual, an individual on drugs, of course, I don't think you can compare a shot of heroin. Can you compare a shot of heroin as the same as a feel-good as someone who makes that purchase of an item they don't need at the department store?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's certainly not going to be the same. But to a person who's making that purchase at the department store, the rush is what they're after. Most of them have plenty of items. They have plenty of clothes. They have plenty of this. They have plenty of that, and they probably don't need anything more. But they buy that for the rush, right? And that's why heroin users use heroin, is for the rush. It's different, of course. But for somebody whose quote-unquote drug of choice is overspending, compulsive overspending, they're going to feel really high and really wonderful, not in the same way as somebody who's using a mind-altering substance. It's just going to be different.
Candace, we're going to have to go into a real short two-minute break here.
Okay.
Folks, Candace Platter, Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, the top 10 survival tips tips for loving someone with an addiction. Candace, please, appreciate your graciousness. Stick with us. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Okay.
And now, more of the Prescription Addiction Radio Show with our host, Larry G.
Folks, back with Candace Platter, author, Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, Top 10 Survival Tips for Loving Someone with an Addiction. Candace.
Yes.
The beginning of your book, A Dramatically Fresh Approach to Loving an Addicted Person. So when you finish interacting with a loved one who is trying to help help the individual suffering from the addiction, a fresh approach, is that how people look at it? Do you see like real looks of relief as you move into the therapy sessions with individuals?
You know, I do. That's a really good way to put it. I see a lot of relief because they know that what I'm saying makes sense. And I think what they find is validation for what they already know. That being said, I do sometimes see people who aren't quite ready to own their own part in this because, you know, loved ones have a part in what's going on with the addiction, and it's really, really vitally important for them to be willing to look at that and to make changes that are necessary for the whole family dynamic to be able to become healthier.
You know, listening to you and having this conversation, this just came to mind for me, Candace. I have got this bias that too many times the loved one, in particular the parent, feels like they're the victim. I've always viewed it as the person who's afflicted with the dependency and the addiction as being the victim, and I've always looked at the parent should be there to try to figure it out. But from my experience, and I'm curious if you do have a comment on this, my experience is that the loved one feels like they're the victim of that individual's actions, and therefore I question if much can be done with that perspective. Do you find people just walking in feeling sorry for themselves personally, or are they past that point by the time they see you, and are they ready for a solution?
Well, I think both are true. Often loved ones are quite victimized by addicts and, you know, the behaviors that addicts can show. There's a saying in 12-step programs that the word that an addict or alcoholic hates to hear the most is no. So they become enraged often. They say things, especially when they're under the influence of something, that are just horrifying to the families. They steal money. They do all kinds of things that are very damaging to the families, and families often do feel victimized. And I don't question that. They have been victimized, but that can stop.
I was thinking
that they can do to stop that and to not be victims.
I was thinking victimized.
So I don't mind starting, you know, with a client. I don't mind starting at a place where they feel victimized because, yeah, they've been victimized. But to some extent, they've been perpetuating themselves as victims. So let's look at that and let's see what they can do to stop that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'm listening intently because there's different perspectives on the word victimized. The way you presented it, 100%. I was thinking in terms of I see individuals that say, "Oh, woe is me. Woe is me." In other words, they're feeling sorry for themselves.
Yep, and that happens too. That can change as well. And until that changes, there's another, you've read it in my book, there's another saying that I absolutely love. I wish I could take credit for it and say that I made it up. It's this amazingly simple, profound saying, if nothing changes, nothing changes.
Isn't that the truth?
So if you've been feeling victimized, woe is me, okay, let's start there. But what can we change? I don't believe that people can change each other. So I'm not sure that a loved one can change an addict. But the loved one can change what he or she is doing, which in turn very well might and often does change what the addict is doing.
In chapter 6, it's common for the addict to blame the loved one. Is that a very real common theme that you hear, that the addict has become so adept at maintaining their lifestyle that they're very good at blaming the loved one, and the loved one backs off?
If they don't blame somebody else and start looking at themselves, an addict is going to have to change what they're doing. And most addicts, when they're in active addiction, don't want to change what they're doing. I should say that underneath that, most addicts want to change what they're doing. Most addicts are not happy with themselves. They don't like the fact that they're addicts. There's a monkey on their back. They don't respect themselves. So I've said something and I'm contradicting myself here, but the thought of changing for an addict, the thought of giving up the behavior or the substance, which has become, you know, the best friend, basically, is very, very scary. Very scary.
Why? So, I've heard that theme a number of times where even a person in recovery or a person on Suboxone or a person on methadone or just... They're actually afraid to move on to the next level.
Yeah.
Any insight on why there's that fear factor of a new that an addicted person has when they have a chance to move on to a new lifestyle?
Well, I would say that it's the same as a loved one has, a fear of changing what they're doing too, a fear of changing the status quo, because we all have our comfort zones. We know what we know, and even if what we know is negative and negatively affecting us and is unhealthy, it's what we know and it's what we're comfortable with.
You know, we're down to about...
But the real truth is that life begins at the end of our comfort zones. I have a fridge magnet that says so.
One more time, our life begins?
Life begins at the end of our comfort zone.
We're going to use that as a soundbite for next week's, our first Tuesday night show. I like that.
Mm.
Hey, we're down to about a minute and a half, Candace. I want last question, because I actually highlighted this. Forget and run, can't enjoy happiness. Is that both the addict and the loved one can't enjoy happiness?
In many cases, yes. They've gotten so entrenched in very unhealthy dynamics. You're talking about fear. You're talking about the acronym for fear, F-E-A-R. Forget everything and run, which is a cleaned-up way of saying it. False evidence appearing real, and face everything and recover. So, you know, forget everything and run. We all know that one. If something's too much for us, we're out of here, right? Fight or flight.
Well, I'll tell you, I guess it just comes down to, as a species, we have a hard time with reality. That's what I'm getting out of it. Candace Platter, one more time, Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, the top 10 survival tips for loving someone with an addiction. I'll tell you, Candace, this was an incredibly quick hour. And
yeah,
I want to thank you.
Quickly for me, too.
For anybody who missed the beginning part of Candace, prescriptiondictionradio.com, prescriptiondictionradio.com. You know, Candace, this interview will be on our website within an hour after the show.
Ah, what's the link for that?
Prescriptiondictionradio.com.
Okay.
Prescriptiondictionradio.com. Also, Tantalk 1340 has a podcast page. So Candace, I'm so happy that you discovered the radio show, and this radio show host is so appreciative of your time. I have enjoyed so much of our time together. The hope is that this radio show is going to grow, and next time you're with us, it'll be on a Tuesday night, and people from more radio stations will be listening. So, Candace Potter, thank you so much.
Maybe you can invite me back closer to the Christmas holidays, because that's the hardest time for loved ones of addicts.
All right. The commitment is on air. Thanks so much.
Okay. Okay, Larry.